Good afternoon, and welcome back to the Jewish Policy Center webinar series. I feel like we've been gone a long time. For those of you who were observing and celebrating, I hope your holidays were warm, reflective, and satisfying. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC and your host. We have a large audience today. I hope that's because you've read Ken Timmerman's book, And the Rest is History, reviewed in the fall issue of In Focus Quarterly, and then because you went out and bought the book and read the whole thing. Before we go to our program, I am going to do a commercial for the JPC. We were established in 1985 as a 501c3 nonprofit organization, providing analysis of both foreign and domestic policies. That's policies, not politics. You can find us on our website, jewishpolicycenter.org. There you can find our insight articles, In Focus Quarterly, our blog in context. See a pattern there? I think you will find our cast of authors in the fall issue of In Focus, which came out a couple of weeks ago, diverse, fascinating, and informative. The title of the issue is What Makes America? Next up will be our agenda for the new Congress, and you can guess what's in that one. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them, especially Hamas, Iran, and the Palestinian Authority, and Australia. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. In this series of calls, we've been trying to provide background to events of the day. In the beginning, we leaned heavily on the impact of coronavirus and the changing view of China that seems to have come with that. We've also looked at internal and foreign policy choices of countries that are America's friends and countries that are America's adversaries. Israel is the top of the first list, and the Abraham Accords broadened our interest in the Persian Gulf and North Africa. Iran is at the top of the second list. We've spent years considering the nuclear and conventional threat Iran poses to the region and farther afield. Today, we're going to look at events that pose a threat, possibly, to the Mullah government. It could be a good day. Our guest is author and journalist Ken Timmerman, a nationally recognized investigative reporter and war correspondent who was nominated for a Nobel Prize for the work he did to expose Iran's nuclear weapons program. He was prominently featured in the documentary Iranium. Iranium? Iranium? I don't know. Since 1995, he has run the Foundation for Democracy in Iran, that is iran.org, and he regularly meets with Iranian dissidents overseas. He has lectured to the Pentagon's Joint Counterintelligence Training Academy on Iran and was the outside investigator for law firms representing the families of 9/11 victims. Based on eyewitness testimony Ken elicited from Iranian defectors, a federal district court judge ruled in 2011 that Iran, quote, shared responsibility with Al-Qaeda for the 9/11 terrorist attacks and awarded $6 billion to the families of 9/11 victims. Aside from his Iran work, for the past 40 years, Ken has covered both sides of the Arab-Israel conflict, interviewing radical imams and would-be suicide bombers in Gaza, and reporting on the plight of Israeli citizens during the 2006 Hezbollah war. In addition, he was early in understanding how the West was supplying weapons technology to China and supplying Iran's Mullah and Saddam Hussein with weapons illegally. His books often involve his own experiences. Running for Congress in Maryland gave birth to The Election Heist. His novel about the Iraq War, ISIS Begins, is based on his many trips to Iraq. As a reporter in 1982, he was taken hostage by Palestinian guerrilla fighters in West Beirut, where he was born again in his Christian faith. He relates that and much more in his new book, And the Rest is History, Tales of Hostages, Arms Dealers, Dirty Tricks, and Spies. which is another opportunity for me to suggest that you go to the JPC website, jewishpolicycenter.org, and read the book review in the fall issue of In Focus Quarterly and buy the book. The late Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal said of Ken, "I have spent my life tracking the murders of yesterday. Mr. Timmerman is tracking the murderers of tomorrow." And with that, Ken Timmerman, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Shoshana, for that incredible introduction. And I hope there's still some time left to discuss Iran. Life is long, isn't it? Look, I'd like to tell you that everything is going great inside Iran today, that the protests are on the verge of toppling the regime. And while there is a lot of good news, and the good news is primarily that the protesters are managing to elude the arrest in some cases. They're not being shut down. They're not being killed into non-existence. They're still getting videos out onto Twitter, into Telegram, into Clubhouse and various internet fora. But I want to just give you right up front my conditions for success of this protest movement. Two things have got to happen for them to actually succeed in toppling the regime. And we're not even close to those things happening at this point. Number one, this has to become a true nationwide movement with buy-in from ethnic minorities. Now, you see protests in Kurdistan, in Balochistan, in Avaz, in the southeast of the country, in the oil fields, very, very important that the oil workers have joined the protest. This is what ultimately led the 1978 revolution to success, was shutting down the oil industry. But the groups, the political groups and the intelligentsia in the ethnic areas, which are basically the entire periphery of Iran, all of it is inhabited by repressed ethnic minorities, Kurds, Baluch, Avazis, etc. They have to buy into this, and the Persian groups in Tehran, who tend to be the voice of the opposition, they have to stop calling the ethnic minority separatists. It's not just name calling, but names are very important. Because the regime is calling them separatists, and as soon as you call somebody a separatist in an Iranian context, they are anathema. You don't want to deal with them. So the first condition is that there's a true buy-in by the Persian-centered organizations to the demands for freedom and respect by the ethnic minorities and their representatives, all these different Kurdish and Baluchi groups. Has not happened yet. The second condition that I would look for is for the IRGC and the Basijis to join the protest movement. Now, I don't mean all of them, but you saw this in 1978 and 1979. You saw a refusal by the army at key moments to shoot fellow Iranians. There have been some reported instances that there are, some of this has happened, that there are sympathies amongst the some of the anti-riot troops, but I haven't seen it widespread. And instead, what you're seeing are these motorcycle gangs, the same ones who kidnapped Mahsa Amini, still roaming the streets of Tehran and other cities, attacking women without hijabs, attacking people in crowds. And until that, until they get exposed and their fellows revolt and refuse to repress these demonstrations, I think they're bound to fail. Now, this is part of there's a long history of these demonstrations, okay? I was involved with FDI in 1999 in helping to get the first internet pictures of the student protests at that time. It was never done before. The internet was a fledgling tool for human rights practitioners. We got photographs almost instantaneously of kids being thrown out dormitory windows, and this helped to impact public opinion. Every couple of years, you have major demonstrations. 2009, 2013, we had again 2019 recently, and now. And they never seem to reach beyond this letting off of steam inside the regime. Sooner or later, the regime just kills enough people, arrests enough people, that the demonstrations subside. Their favorite tactic is to shut down the internet, and then they kill in the darkness. They've done that, but the young people today have skills that their older brothers and sisters did not have. You now have something like 120 million cell phone lines in Iran, in a country with an 80 million population. People have multiple cell phone lines. They have widespread access to the internet, and they're managing to circumvent the internet censorship and get information out. That is the good. That's the good news part of it. But again, I think there are these two real big conditions to any kind of success. Now, I would also watch for defections. Okay. Watch for the rats jumping ship. There was a report last week. It's an unverified rumor at this point that Omidvar Rezai, who is the brother of the former commander of the Rev Guards, now Iran's vice president for economic affairs, Mohsen Rezai. Omid Rezai is the family's bagman, if you wish. And there were rumors last week that he had recently visited Canada and invested $150 million in real estate north of Toronto. Now, I've not been able to verify this, and I've talked to friends in Canada to see if they can. At this point, it's an unsubstantiated rumor. However, when that kind of thing starts to happen, you know the rats are jumping ship. And when the rats jump ship, or Mohsen Rezai, for example, should he request political asylum outside of the country? He is now allowed to travel, which he has not been allowed to do up until recently by the regime, because his son defected to the United States. In fact, I happen to know something about it. He lived in our basement for 6 months and learned English watching Jackie Chan movies. So I know an awful lot about Mohsen Rezai and his family. And he was, you know, there was an attempt to recruit him by the United States government, which failed because of the ineptness of certain CIA officers a number of years ago. If someone like this jumps ship, requests political asylum, then you know the regime is going down. Okay, so I would just pose those as conditions to sort of frame a discussion. One other thing I do want to mention before we get to questions is that this Sunday is the 39th anniversary of the attack on the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut that killed 241 U.S. Marines. It was the largest loss of life for the Marines since Iwo Jima, an extraordinary attack. We know now for a fact that the Revolutionary Guards was responsible for that with Hezbollah. Imad Mugniyeh, their chief agent, their chief operative in Lebanon, was the one who orchestrated the attack, along with Hossein Dagan, who is the IRGC chief of operations in Lebanon at the time. He has now been designated by the Trump administration as he's a specially designated terrorist. The Biden people like to lift sanctions on Mohsen Rezai, who was his boss, on Dagan and other individuals in the government, such as Ahmed Vahidi, another well-known terrorist. He has an AMIA red notice out for him, as does Rezai, an Interpol red notice for the AMIA bombings out on him, as does Mohsen Rezai. So, you know, there are a lot of things going on. There are individuals in this government who are well-known terrorists. I believe, and I argue in my book, and the rest is history, that had we responded to the 1983 Marine barracks bombings militarily, as was the plan, the jets were gassed and ready to go. The bombs were under the wings, and they were ready to go. In November of 1983, I was on the ground at the time, and I described this in my book. And instead of being a U.S.-French joint raid to punish the Iranians for those attacks, it was a French-only raid. And oh, by the way, because the French leak all the time, the Iranians got advance warning, and no Iranians were killed when they hit Baalbek, just a shepherd and a bunch of sheep. I still believe, and I argue in my book, that had we attacked at that time, the entire face of the Middle East would have been different. Iran would not have emerged from those attacks as an international terror exporting state. They would have learned their lesson in many ways. We would have held them in check. Instead, they've learned one thing very, very clearly. They can act with impunity. No one will ever punish them. Economic sanctions enrich the Revolutionary Guards and actually strengthen the regime. That might sound counterintuitive to some of the people listening to this call, and I'm in favor of economic sanctions. I'm not saying this to say sanctions, but they have strengthened the regime. They have rallied the troops around the regime, and the regime takes care of its own. So the IRGC has got their overseas assets have expanded. And now we see the Biden administration preparing to release a lot of those assets, just as the Obama administration did in 2015, $150 billion. What did they do? They didn't help the Iranian people. It helped them build up their weapons infrastructure. It helped them to fuel the wars in Syria, Iraq, and in Yemen. And it helped them to become a more powerful government. So I think that obviously, helping the pro-freedom movement at Iran, something I've argued in favor of for many, many years, is in our national security interest. This administration is not doing it. Even our broadcasting, the Voice of America, Radio Farda, is, I would say, lukewarm in their support for the protests. Where we have seen the biggest support has been from people like, Elon Musk sending Starlink receivers to Iran. Now, I hear from friends on the ground that they aren't working so well, but nevertheless, for a private individual to become a greater support of the pro-freedom movement in Iran than the United States government is a disgrace on that U.S. government. So I think what I'll do is kind of stop there and let people ask questions, because I think that might be a better way to exchange information here than just listen to me drone on.
You can drone. It's fine.
I don't explode. I try not to explode on targets on the ground when I drone.
Thank you. So let's start where you stopped. You advocate that the U.S. government should do more for the anti-regime protesters. What should we do? What could the U.S. government do that would be helpful in your view?
Well, let's set this off in two different piles here. What would I like them to do? What would be the maximum that they could do? And what are they likely to do? What they are likely to do, even this administration, I think, is a certain amount of shaming, public shaming. They are likely to go to the United Nations and talk. Well, that's not going to hurt a lot of people in the regime in Tehran. They can talk all they want. They really don't care. What I would like to see happen is a ramping up of Voice of America and Radio Farda. Let them become true vehicles of a two-way communication into Iran and out of Iran. That's how they were conceived in the beginning, a way of giving the Iranian people a surrogate broadcasting, the kind of broadcasting that they could not get from their national media. So we would provide it to Voice of America. That was its initial charter. We haven't done that. Radio Farda is a way of giving them a freedom radio, actually empowering and emboldening activists on the ground, citizen journalists. And there are now lots of them inside Iran, lots of citizen journalists inside Iran with their cell phones and with internet connections. And Radio Farda should be used as a way of getting that information out and to the world, so this regime cannot kill in the silence. They can't kill in darkness. Beyond that, I think it's very important that we delegitimize the regime. And it's something that you obviously are not doing if you're negotiating with them. If you're negotiating with them over their nuclear weapons capabilities, how absurd is that, by the way? Just think of that. You're actually negotiating with a regime, with a terrorist regime, about putting limits on their nuclear weapons capabilities, and you think they're going to honestly negotiate with you and agree to limits? In 2015, and they're certainly not going to do so today. So stop the nuclear negotiations, just cut them off completely. And maybe we should think of doing the kind of things to the Iranian regime that, we're doing to Russia. Treat them as a pariah state, kick them out of the, they've been out of SWIFT for some time, but really put an embargo on Iranian oil being sold around the world. So there are many, many, many more things that we can do. We're not doing any of them.
So I will note, unhappily, that our chief negotiator in Vienna said it's not a priority right now. When he was talking about the Vienna talks and the nuclear negotiations, he didn't say we're not doing it because this is an unacceptable regime. He said it's not a priority. And I think that really tells you where the Biden administration is. Okay, we'll downplay it for now and maybe we'll upplay it later.
Right.
We had someone ask how the sanctions enrich the regime. If you'd give us a little bit more detail on how it works, that we think that we are preventing them from getting money, and in fact, they're being strengthened by this.
What's happened with the sanctions is that commerce between legitimate Iranian industry or traders and the outside world has been blocked. Okay, so if you are a bazaari. And bazaari means basically an international trader, right, in Tehran, and you want to do business with Germany, import cars or something like that, you're going to have a very hard time doing that. However, if you are a Revolutionary Guards general, because the bazaari import cars, you can go through your black market networks in Syria and Iran and import stolen cars, for example, and make a killing. If you are not allowed as a government to sell your oil on international markets, which, by the way, they are now, but there was a time under Trump, under maximum pressure, when they were not allowed to sell their oil on international markets, they would do is the Revolutionary Guards would then sell the oil through intermediaries, or they would sell it through Iraq. Yes, they would sell through Iraq. They'd launder their oil through Iraq, and they've been doing this for years and years and years. So they would enrich themselves that way. The Revolutionary Guards also has an extraordinary arrangement with the Iraqi finance ministry. They've had time, actually, where they get the float on the currency float every week from all of the banks in Iraq. And at one point I did a calculation of how much it amounts to, and it's something like $1 billion a month. So they got about $12 billion in foreign currency off books completely, that they're just siphoning off of the financial networks, the financial system of Iraq, and able to use for terrorist purposes around the world. And they do.
So when you close off the legitimate avenues, all the bad guys take over.
That's right. That's right. Exactly what's happened. Now, not to say that sanctions aren't good. I'm all in favor of sanctions. Let me repeat it. But let us just be aware that the bad guys see this as an opportunity, and they are truly making out like bandits. And by the way, our friends in Europe are not cracking down on them. They are not exposing their financial networks in Germany, in Luxembourg, in Switzerland, in France. And those networks exist, and they are thriving. They are not exposing them in Canada. I mentioned Omid Varvazai, but he's not the only one. The Canadians know that the sons and daughters, the princelings, the princelings of Tehran, right? They are going back and forth to Canada. Most of them have green cards. Some of them have Canadian citizenship, and all of them have bank accounts and real estate. So none of this has been shut down. None of that has been shut down.
Which is in contrast to a lot of the things that have happened to Russian oligarchs and their families and their children. So we really are treating them differently.
Yes, that's right.
Think about that. Something else to think about. We talked about this before the program started, and I asked you if, so there's a question here, are the demonstrations getting bigger or smaller? And in that context, I asked you about the fire in Evin prison. And I thought that was sort of a good sign. I mean, it seems to me interesting that one of what must be the most hated places in all of Tehran for the Iranian people had a huge fire. And you said something interesting. What did you say to me?
Well, I'm a little bit suspicious of who actually set that fire. And it would be a very convenient way for the regime to get rid of some pesky prisoners sitting in Evin. We know that 8 people died in the fire. Over 50 were injured. I would say 8 is probably a small number, and I would not be surprised to learn in the coming weeks that a number of very high high profile political prisoners were actually murdered undercover of that fire. So yeah, it's kind of nice to see Evan go up in smoke, or at least a part of it go up in smoke, but be careful what you wish for.
Yes, that seems to be a theme here that you're giving us. We had a couple of people ask if you would say some more about the potential of retaliation against Iran for the Marine barracks bombing and the fact that it didn't happen. How come it didn't happen?
Well, I tell part of that story in my book, and the rest is history. And I also recount it as a journalistic investigation in Countdown to Crisis in the second chapter of that book. Look, there was an intercept that the U.S. intelligence community received 2 days before the bombing, which is October 23rd, 1983. It was not distributed. It was not distributed up and down the chain of command. I afterwards interviewed General Vesey, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I interviewed Caspar Weinberger, the then Secretary of Defense, who told me they had no idea who had carried out the Marine barracks bombing. And if they did, of course, we would have attacked them. But we had no clue and no intelligence on who did it. That's an extraordinary statement. It's a flat out lie. But one thing that did stand out to me was that it was explained by General Vesey and by Ace Lyons, who was the chief of naval operations and in charge of preparing the retaliatory raid. It was explained to me that intelligence, as it went into the Pentagon, to the Secretary of Defense and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was there was a choke point for that intelligence, and it was the military aid to the Secretary of Defense. And at the time, in 1983, the military aid was I believe he was a young colonel at the time, named Colin Powell. And Colin Powell did not allow that intelligence to be disseminated. I tried many, 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 many times to contact Secretary Powell when he was at the State Department, and afterwards when he was retired, to get him to comment on this and to talk about this. He refused. He would not talk about it at all. But he appears to be the one. And I don't want to just personalize this about Powell. There was a, even in the 9/11 Commission, when the 9/11 Commission finally got its information about Iran in the last days before they published a report in July of 2004, there was a very strenuous debate and pushback from the professional staff of the commission to not publish it at all. Because what they learned about Iran's involvement in 9/11 was that there had been meetings in Tehran that with al-Qaeda. They learned that Imad Mughniyeh, Iran's chief foreign terrorist operative, was shuttling back and forth between Beirut and Tehran, bringing the 9/11 hijackers there so they could go through Iran into Afghanistan to receive their final orders with no stamps on their passports. By that time, they already had fresh Saudi passports with fresh U.S. visas in them. And had they had a Pakistani stamp on an Afghan stamp on their passport, they would not have been allowed to come into this country, and 9/11 wouldn't happen. So the Iranians let them come into Iran with no stamps, with no passport stamps, slipped them over the border, and then slipped them back and sent them back with Imad Mughniyeh to Beirut or Damascus, wherever they were. So we learned all these things from the 9/11 Commission, but there is a group of professional deep staters, if you wish, in the intelligence community and the diplomatic community, who believe that should we ever take military action against the Iranian regime, we would be so thoroughly defeated, it would be such a catastrophe for the United States, that we should never think about it. We should never think about it. Condi Rice sent, the former chief of staff of the 9/11 Commission in 2005 to Iraq, to look at Iranian misdoings there, because the Iranians were already beginning to use these specially formed penetrators killing American troops. And he recommended that we keep it quiet. Do not talk about it. Do not make it public. And it was not made public for another 2 years. It wasn't made public until 2007 that we learned that something like 600 U.S. troops had been killed in Iraq by the Iranians. By the Iranians.
So that raises another kind of question. Let's broaden our scope just a bit. So if there was in the United States, and maybe there remains in the United States, a kind of concern that if we attack Iran frontally or even sideways, the result will be really bad for us. Now, at the same time, you have Iran and Russia forming a new relationship that includes drones, which is a violation of UN sanctions on Russia and a violation of UN sanctions on Iran. They're not allowed to export weapons in theory. What does this tell us about what the United States might do about Russia? And what does it tell us about Iran's willingness to poke its nose into things outside of its area of influence in the Middle East, directly in opposition to United States interests? Are the Iranians gaining, confidence in their ability to play on the international stage that way?
Well, do we want to talk about Ezekiel 38?
Do we? I don't know. Do we?
Look, Ezekiel 38 talks about a coalition that will come to pass in the end of days between the kings of the north, the kings of the east, Persia, and a number of different countries in the Middle East. And I think what you're seeing today is a Russia, China, Iran strategic coalition that is very similar to what was evoked or spoken about in the Bible, and is very real. And you see it on the ground. And it's been building for years. You know, you can go back to 1981, 1982 during the Iran-Iraq War. Again, I talk about this a bit in my book. And you can see the beginnings of Russia-Iran and Iran-China getting together. Mohsen Rezai, again, was starting to go to North Korea and China already in 1982 to purchase missiles and to bring missile technology and manufacturing technology back to Iran. So they have a strategic relationship. Recently, Iran was invited into the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement, which is a regional grouping set up by Russia, but as well that includes the stands, right? And Iran had been an observer for years. Now they are a full-fledged member. Russia and Iran hold joint naval exercises. The Chinese have been invited into these joint naval exercises. It is a strategic relationship which benefits both sides. If you had told me 2 years ago that Russia would be importing Iranian drones, I would have told you, you're out of your mind. The Iranians can't produce enough of them for themselves. And besides, we've been told for years that the Russians have invested $650 billion in upgrading their conventional weapons capabilities over the past decade. Well, we certainly haven't seen that on the battlefield in Ukraine. The Russians are getting mauled. So they actually turn to the Iranians. Maybe it could very well be that they've aided them with production technology to expand a drone production plant in Iran. But the Iranians have really focused a lot. They have always focused with their weapons production on niche products, things that either would give them an unconventional asymmetrical leg up on the battlefield, missiles, drones, in particular speedboats in the Persian Gulf. They use arms and instead of building destroyers and combat aircraft and main battle tanks and stuff like that. So they are able to get a big bang out of just a couple of billion reals. Sound like a lot of money, but you could put all that in your pocket.
Okay, so you've just told us that this is a long-standing relationship between Russia and Iran, maybe ramped up a little bit now. How do you account for the fact that the United States was allowing Russia to be, and China, to be our interlocutor in Vienna in the room with the Iranians, while we were outside in the lobby of the hotel? How does this work?
It's mind-boggling. I think, as Michael Ledeen would say, it's worse than a crime. It's a fault. It's an error. We should never have done something like that. But let me tell you a story to illustrate how longstanding this relationship with Russia and Iran has been going on. In 1995, Bill Clinton was preparing for a summit meeting with Boris Yeltsin, then the president of Russia. And shortly before the summit meeting, he was given intelligence that the U.S. had discovered that Russia had signed a nuclear protocol with the Iranian regime. And it was a military nuclear protocol. That was how the Russians themselves described it. Part of the protocol was to build a centrifuge enrichment plant, okay? Another part of the protocol was to build an underground test site, test shaft, they called it, okay? So when Clinton goes to see Yeltsin, I think it was October of 95, he comes back with this big victory, and he said, I got Yeltsin to cancel the military parts, nuclear cooperation agreement with Iran. And I remember at the time reporting on this and just scratching my head and saying, wait a second, do you realize what you just said? You just said that you got the Russians to stop providing nuclear weapons to Iran, and you think that's a big victory? That should be the first step of really whacking them. And breaking those two countries apart, splitting them apart, so they cannot ever do something like that again. And we also learned at about the same time that the Russian general staff had strategic papers circulating amongst them, which leaked out to the West, that described and explained why it was in Russia's strategic interest to have military relationships with both Iran and Iraq. This is the time when they also got caught by the U.S. providing gyroscopes from SS-18 missiles to Hussein, and Saddam had buried them in the Tigris River, and the UN arms inspectors managed to find out where they were and dig them up. So it was there. They considered it was their strategic interest to have strategic military relationships with both Iran and Iraq, and to help both countries to acquire strategic weapons to hold the United States at bay, and ultimately to drive us out of the Persian Gulf.
So we're looking at this, and we now know a lot of things we perhaps didn't know before. And I know you've just told us a bunch of things we didn't know before. How good would you say U.S., Israeli, and other Western intelligence sources inside Iran are? And that's a two-pronged question. One is about bringing out information about the demonstrations. That's the current immediate interest every night on the news. But secondly, those long-term relations and what Iran is actually doing in its weapons programs. How good are we?
I'm going to shock you here, Shoshana. CNN is better than CIA these days. And they have actually, the past week, have run some pretty interesting investigative pieces on the ground in northern Iraq. With Iranian dissidents, people who have gotten out into the Kurdish areas, and they've showed some of these women. I love these girls with guns. In the next volume of my memoir, it's going to be a chapter called Girls with Guns, and it's about these Kurdish women guerrilla fighters that I got to meet many, many times in Iraq in their training camps right along the Iranian border. So CNN went there, and they have, you can see what this looks like. These are young women, you know, 18, 19, early 20s, in military uniforms and drilling up there in the mountains. The CIA has been notorious in recent years for losing sources in Iran, for losing entire networks of sources in Iran, for not protecting sources after they have been jailed and then released. There have been a number of media reports about this recently, where American reporters have gone and found some of those people who claim to have been recruited by the CIA, arrested by the Iranians, thrown in jail 5, 6, 7 years. And then they explained exactly how the CIA was communicating with them. And the covert communications were just sloppy, unbelievably sloppy, if these accounts are true. But I think, look, the proof is in the pudding. You know, if we had great intelligence on Iran, we would be acting differently. Instead, you find the leading edge of our intelligence is the Treasury Department, the Defense Department. Now, that's, again, not necessarily a bad thing, but read the Treasury Department's designations. When they designate an Iranian individual as a foreign terrorist, some of it gets quite detailed. And that's where you see the fruit of American intelligence. But I would argue, and I suspect, it is not the fruit of human intelligence. It's not sources on the ground. We have never carried out an operation like the Israelis did, going in and getting the nuclear archive. That has got to be one of the most extraordinary intel operations of all times. They went into Tehran, to the lion's den, literally into the lion's den, the heart of darkness, right? The heart of the beast. And they didn't just go in there with one or two people. They had moving vans. They evacuated, you know, a moving van full of boxes that they got out of safes, you know, big, thick safes inside a nondescript warehouse, and they brought them out of the country, and bit by bit, they've been releasing that information. And Israel's a tiny country, and Mossad probably has, you know, at best, you know, 1/10 the number of operatives, if that, as the CIA. And yet look at what they've accomplished. And they've accomplished it because of the ethos of that organization. The CIA today, I like to say it's CIA, CYA. They are covering their rear ends. And there's an old story told by former operatives, people I've gotten to know over the years. It goes like this. I've got a big case. Oh, you've got a big problem. I've got a small case. You've got a small problem. I've got no cases. You've got no problems at all. So no cases, no problems.
Prompting a question from a listener. If the US is not going to attack Iran, is it possible to get the United States to give Israel the weapons that they might need to attack Iran if that's what they choose to do?
First of all, the US doesn't give Israel anything that I'm aware of. Israel does happen to purchase most of their weapons. Okay, there is some U.S. aid that goes back into the pockets of U.S. defense companies when they're buying equipment. They have the F-35.
All of it goes back in. 100% of the money that the U.S. gives to Israel on an annual basis has to be spent in the United States.
In military aid.
In military. They don't give them any economic or other aid.
Okay. So it's coming back into our own coffers, all right? It's a kind of U-turn. I don't even know if it goes to Israel before it turns back.
It's defense spending. It's U.S. defense spending.
Right. So we help Lockheed Martin produce extra F-35s, which are then sent to Israel and are incorporated in the Israeli Air Force. Given the track record of the Israeli Air Force and their known propensity to adapt American weapons and to improve upon them and to do things with them for whatever reason we had not thought of doing with them. They've done that with previous aircraft, extending their range, putting new radar in them, new capabilities. And from what I know about Israel's military exercises over the past few years, they have the capabilities of striking Iranian nuclear weapon sites. They have those capabilities today. They have bunker busting bombs. They have F-35s. But except for a very brief period in recent Israeli history, the inclination has been to go after Iran's programs, to delay Iran's programs through non-kinetic means. And they've been very successful. They've been very successful blowing up. Well, that's kinetic, but, you know, blowing up missile factories, Stuxnet going after the centrifuges, killing nuclear scientists, that has been pretty effective as well. But there will come a time, and I think that time is approaching quickly, where Israel will have to strike Iran, because we won't do it. The question in my mind is not, will they have the technology, the weapons to do it? The question in my mind is, will the U.S. government, will the Biden administration retaliate against Israel, not against Iran? That is my biggest fear, that the U.S. government will respond retaliating against Israel.
That is a terrifying thought. And because we're coming sort of to the end of the program, and I cannot leave a program on a negative note, we're going to have to stay here for another minute until we get past this. So let's spread our wings just a tad. the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Kuwaitis, the Bahrainis, all these people have changed their view of Israel over the last couple of years. And a piece of that was their concern about Iran. And clearly they were interested in having Israel on their side of the Great Divide as regards the threat posed by Iran. In your view, I know you watch this, not quite as much as you watch Iran, but you do. Are those guys still counting on Israel and or the United States to protect them? Or, frighteningly, are they trying to reconcile with Tehran for fear that we won't help them?
They're not trying to reconcile with Tehran, okay? But I think what you've seen, especially with the Saudis recently, and the ridiculous attitude of the Biden administration towards Mohammed bin Salman over the Adnan Khashoggi murder. The Saudis have pretty much given up on us. You now have Democrats in the Senate saying that they are going to punish Saudi Arabia for not willing to decrease oil production until after the midterm elections. I mean, come on, how transparent is that? Talks about transferring U.S. defense Patriot missile batteries from Saudi Arabia to Ukraine, taking them away from the Saudis. So what are the Saudis doing? They're talking to Russia. They're talking to Russia. By the way, OPEC plus is OPEC plus Russia, all right? And they're the ones that jointly decided on the 2 million a day barrel per day production cut. Now, all of that said, the Abraham Accords, which are peace agreements between Bahrain, the United Arab Morocco, Sudan, with Israel, are a true game changer, a true game changer. In the first year after President Trump and Jared Kushner and others who you have talked about, negotiated these just extraordinary deals, beneficial deals for everybody involved, trade between Israel and the UAE went from zero to $650 million. Today, I think it's in the billions of dollars. And the Emiratis are just, they're going to town. And they see, look, what this did was essentially end the Palestinian mafia. And the Palestinian mafia stranglehold over the Gulf sheikdoms. That's something else I talk about in And the Rest is History. They put an end, the PLO can no longer blackmail those countries because they've got Israel on their side. So that is even more important than the Iran factor. The Iran factor was important. It's especially important with the Saudis, but now they have set themselves free. And I'm just waiting for Kuwait and other countries to join the Accords. They won't do it while Biden is still in office because there's no incentive and it's not U.S. policy. Anything that Trump did is not U.S. policy any longer. Let us just hope and pray that the U.S. embassy remains in Jerusalem where it belongs and try to do what Australia just did.
So you've gotten us, as I hoped you would, to a positive point.
Except for that last bit, I take that. I will revise and extend my remarks, right?
Later, yeah.
Forget all that.
But basically, okay, what I gather, and I do, people who watch this program know that I have to end on a positive note, otherwise I feel like I failed. But the Abraham Accords are a positive note.
Oh, yes, oh, yes.
And the idea that the Palestinian mafia has lost its power against the Gulf states, and Saudi Arabia has said as much, they're not interested in funding the corrupt regime. So you've brought us to a positive place. You were a little less positive on the Iranian revolution than I hoped you'd be, but again, not really down in the dumps, but a great deal of information. So Ken Timmerman, thank you for enlightening us. Thank you for keeping us sort of ahead of where we need to be. When we watch the news tonight, we will be better able to understand what's going on in Iran and probably in the United States as well. And that's a huge benefit to us. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.